Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and it is a wonderful lineup of folks, and it's a very timely topic for us to consider here on this Saturday afternoon. Our first speaker is Philip Munoz, who's a professor of political science at Notre Dame, also teaching in the law school. His area of specialization is in church-state issues, and he's the author of a book entitled God and the Founders, as well as a collection of primary source material on church-state issues during the era of the founding of the United States. So he's obviously, you know, a great person here to bring his expertise to bear on the kind of challenges that Father White identified in his opening remarks. So please welcome Philip Munoz.
Good afternoon. It's such a pleasure and honor for me to be here with you today, to be in the company of so many people who I've learned from, some of my own teachers, and so many people whom I respect. Thank you to Father Thomas Joseph and to Father Legge, both for the invitation and your leadership of this wonderful institute, which is so important this time. Thank you to Rusty for the kind introduction and for your leadership with the magazine, which is very important. I have a few old friends in the audience, so I want to recognize them. Thank you for coming. It's actually very meaningful to me that you're here. A few former students as well. The subject of my remarks this afternoon is how faithful Catholics should be disposed toward the American project and self-government. It's not an easy time to defend America right now. Our political system, as you know, is in a mess, the one bipartisan thing we all seem to agree upon. Our Congress can't do anything productive. Our executive does whatever he wants. Supreme Court remakes the Constitution whenever it wants to comply with the morality, the social and political morality of our Ivy League elites. Many of our schools are fine, but many are terrible, especially in poor and minority neighborhoods. We have many wonderful colleges, but many are, maybe most, are morally corrupt. We know our social welfare state is going to drive us bankrupt, but we do nothing about it. And our military, really the pride of the nation for so many years, it's not clear that we lost the last two wars we fought, but it's also not clear that we won them. And to solve all these problems, half the country, maybe more than half the country, wants to elect Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders. What happened? What happened to our governing institutions? And an honest assessment of the moral character of the American people doesn't really fare much better. There are indications that Americans, especially younger Americans, are becoming more pro-life, and that's cause for joy, but we still abort the unborn at genocidal rates. Out-of-wedlock births continue to rise. Institution of marriage is falling apart, especially among those without a college education. Rates of addiction, drugs, painkillers, pornography, any number of other social pathologies reflect a decaying culture that Charles Murray aptly termed coming apart. So what happened to our people? And I haven't even mentioned religious liberty, which is actually the one thing I know something about. One has hopes, maybe, that church-state conflicts will go away under President Clinton, because as she said in a speech last year, she will... Religious beliefs have to be changed. So I presume she'll do that in her first 100 days of office. So it's a bad time to be an American, and it's especially difficult time to be a Catholic American. I'm sorry, I sort of feel guilty. The Catholic guilt, you know, starting a conference with a sort of bleak outlook. But that's where we are, I think. That's the reality in which we are living. And where we are is not good, and the direction we're tending seems to be even worse. So we have to ask ourselves, what happened? How did we arrive at our current state? And what should we do about it? How should Catholics, really any people of faith, think about America? And this brings me to the subject of my remarks. It's become fashionable in some conservative Catholic circles to blame America's decay on America's founding principles. According to this neo-Catholic critique, I'm not sure if this is, if you're Facebook friends with me, you'll know there's a debate on my Facebook page on what I should call the critics. I'm going to call them the neo-Catholics, but my friends think I should call them the paleo-Catholics. According to the neo-Catholic critics, as I shall call them, we have become what we are because of, not in spite of, our founding political principles. Our founding political principles, they say, were always corrupt. It took a while, they claim, but finally our principles have played themselves out. Our political institutions and cultural practices, they say, have fully assimilated the deepest liberal commitments on which we were founded, and this results in the decadence and deplorable conditions of contemporary American political and cultural life. I believe these neo-Catholic critics of America are wrong, and I'm going to spend a few minutes with you this afternoon trying to explain why. Here's the plan. I'm going to try to summarize the critique and then try to explain why the founding political principles are not, in fact, susceptible to it. And then I want to conclude with a few thoughts about why, what issues are at stake in this debate. It might seem like an overly academic debate, but I think it's quite serious. And then, of course, hopefully have some time for discussion. The quick summary of my argument is that the neo-Catholic critics do not really understand our founding principles. Most of them, or at least some of them, seem not to actually even studied or read what the American founders actually said and wrote. This leads them to mistake what the late Jean Bethy Elstein labeled ultra-liberalism for the founding's liberalism. Ultra-liberalism is different from American liberalism. So I don't actually disagree with the indictment the neo-Catholic critics make of ultra-liberalism, but they mistakenly extend their critique to our founding principles because I think they misunderstand those principles. I'll even name names. So who are these neo-Catholic critics? The critic most well-known, probably to this crowd, is my good friend and Notre Dame colleague Patrick Deneen. Patrick reinvigorated and popularized the critique with Rusty Reno's help, I might add, in his 2012 First Things essay, Unsustainable Liberalism. More recently, Michael Hanby, told you I was going to come after you, has taken to the pages of First Things to make a similar, though I must say more modest, critique. Other critics include, perhaps well known to this audience, Patrick Brennan, who holds a chair in Catholic Legal Studies at Villanova, David Schindler, a professor of theology at the JP2 Institute, and I think, I'm not sure about this, but I think the intellectual godfather of this crowd is Alistair McIntyre. Let me add, and I'm sure I don't actually need to add this, but let me add, I hope you understand that my disagreement with these critics is not meant to be in any way personal. Patrick Deneen is a close friend, probably one of my best friends at Notre Dame. I was the chair of the search committee that unfortunately hired him. Some of these gentlemen are close friends, others I don't know very well or don't know well at all. But it's because I take their work seriously that I want to engage them and explain why I disagree. Friendship shouldn't allow us to paper over real intellectual disagreements. In fact, friendship allows those disagreements to be aired in a fair and friendly manner. That's what I'm going to try to do. Okay, the criticism has three basic points. Their first point is that they claim America is part of a larger liberal political project, and the political philosophy that underlies this modern project, denies any notion of objective truth, an objective truth that obligates men or imposes duties upon men. Liberalism, including American liberalism, according to the critics, is built upon a rejection of the idea of natural law and the related notion of teleology. According to the critics, liberalism vanquishes the idea of the human good. It replaces respect for and appreciation of the good for neutrality. A liberal regime purportedly is neutral towards all competing conceptions of the good. But of course, they point out neutrality is anything but neutral. And this leads to the second point of the critique. Liberalism, secondly, they say, smuggles in an implicit understanding of the human person. Professor Deneen states this matter about as clearly as you can. Liberalism is constituted by a pair of deeper anthropological assumptions, he says, that give rise to liberal institutions, and that give liberal institutions a particular orientation and cast: anthropological individualism and human separation from and opposition to nature. By anthropological individualism and a voluntaristic conception of choice, Professor Dineen means that liberalism teaches that the essence of man lies in our capacity to make willful choices. And liberalism decides a priori that there are no wrong or bad choices. That there are no wrong or bad choices implicitly rejects classical and Christian ideas of natural right and natural law. So liberalism, they say, the critics say, isn't really neutral. It's based upon and promotes a radically modern conception of the human person. Liberal man becomes somebody by creating himself. To put it in the more refined words of Alistair MacIntyre, the individual moral agent, freed from hierarchy and teleology, conceives himself and is conceived of by moral philosophers as sovereign in his moral authority. Liberalism accordingly replaces obligations with rights. Liberalism can't assert a notion of intrinsic moral obligation because, in the words of Professor Schindler, liberal freedom is not originally intrinsically conditioned by anything beyond the self. It consists in acts of choice that is a priori unbounded. Liberalism's denial of an objective moral order and its underlying understanding of man as an autonomous, choosing, willful being gives rise to the third element of the neo-Catholics' criticism. Their claim that the decline of America into decadence, relativism, and materialism was inevitable. Our current situation is because of our principles, not in spite of them. Every political regime, they rightfully point out, fosters a certain type of citizen. Liberalism fosters liberal citizens. Liberal citizens, they say, become relativists because we hold no objective standards of right and wrong. What is more quintessentially American than to say, you have your values, I have my values. Who's to say? Liberal citizens, they say, become technocratic materialists because we understand nature, including human nature, as something to be controlled and manipulated for our own purposes and desires. Put these traits together, the critics say, and you can see how American culture both ushered in and was overcome by the sexual revolution. Since the liberal citizen understands every aspect of his life to be governed solely by free choices and understands that no choices are really good or bad, if you want to have your baby, you can, but you don't have to. You can abort it. If you want to get married, you can, and you can marry anyone you desire. If you no longer want to be a man, become a woman. It's your body. Abortion, gay marriage, transgenderism, these are all the fulfillment of American principles, not deviations from them, according to the critics. If you want to understand the true character of America, the neo-Catholic critics say, just look to the Supreme Court. And its famous passage in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Okay, I hope no one leaves because that's the criticism, but that's what I'm going to criticize. It's a criticism. Okay, let me start with the claim that the founders and the founding rejects the idea of objective truth. It's simply not true. The political philosophy of the American founding is reflected in many documents, but nowhere more authoritatively than in the Declaration of Independence. And as you know, the Declaration's argument begins with a statement of truth. I didn't put a slide. I presumed you knew, right? But we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Self-evident, I should add, in this audience, doesn't necessarily mean obvious or known by everyone. Jefferson uses self-evident the same way that Aquinas uses self-evident, that the predicate is contained within the subject. So in what sense are men created equal? What is the truth that the Declaration teaches? Jefferson offered, I think, the best explanation and the clearest explanation of the meaning of the Declaration at the end of his life. So Jefferson, as I'm sure you know, Jefferson and Adams, you know, the two men most responsible for the composition and that we declared independence, died on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration. It's providential if you believe in those sort of things. Jefferson is an old man, and there's going to be a national celebration in Philadelphia in 1826, and they asked Jefferson to, please come to Philadelphia, celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Declaration. I mean, Jefferson is literally about to die, and so this is the penultimate letter of his life, and he writes to the organizers to explain the meaning of the Declaration of Independence. And this is from his letter to Roger Waitman. He says, May it be to the world what I believe it will be, to some parts sooner, to others later, but finally to all. The signal arousing men to burst the chains under which monkish ignorance and superstition had persuaded them to bind themselves and to assume the blessings and security of self-government. And then look at the bold-faced text. The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their back, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. Horses, of course, are also not born with saddles on their back. But it is legitimate that men break horses, saddle them, and ride them for their own purposes, for the men's purposes. A good owner should treat his steed humanely, of course, but men legitimately may use horses in ways that primarily benefit the man, the owner. Men may govern horses without their consent because of the species inequality between mankind and animals. Horses are incapable of rational consent, though you wouldn't know that if you were a philosophy major. Jefferson's point is that no similar inequality exists among adult men. No man may legitimately rule another man as a man may legitimately rule an animal, because all men, by nature, have an equal title to govern themselves, to exercise dominion over their own life and liberty. All men are created equal means that no man by nature is the rightful ruler or owner of any other man. Legitimate government of men over other men, therefore, is only established via consent. Notice that the truth of human equality has its foundation in the created order of nature. The founders do not say, "We are declaring this truth of human equality because that's what we believe. We've decided that. It's a matter of our will. We choose to make men equal." No, willful choice is not their starting point. The founders recognize a truth about man that is established by God and reflected in our own human nature and man's place within the whole of God's created nature. Humans properly rule over animals because of our natural superiority over them. I presume this is why in the book of Genesis, man names the animals. But among humans, no man by nature stands in relationship to another man like men stand in relationship to the beasts. In giving mankind a common human nature, God made all men equal. The Declaration recognizes this truth, and in this sense, it lies within the natural law tradition. To say the Declaration is a natural law document isn't to say it's a Thomistic document, of course. The natural law truth of the Declaration recognizes is a claim about human freedom, that God made all individuals equal in our natural freedom to order our own lives. To say that all men are by nature equal is to say that we are all created equally free and independent of one another. And I put these two quotes up here. I mean, this is not just the Declaration of Independence. This political philosophy is all over the founding. It's everywhere in the founding. Every state except Rhode Island and Connecticut wrote constitutions, right? Throwing off an old government, we need new governments. I don't know, Rhode Island and Connecticut, still two of the worst governed states in the nation, didn't get around to doing this. Most of the states at the time of the founding prefaced their constitutions with declarations of rights or bills of rights. And I give you, the first one is the 1776 Virginia Declaration of Rights, older than the Constitution itself. The last one of the founding era is in New Hampshire, 1784. So I give you the first and last, and they both stand out, start the same way. For the founders, our God-given freedom is the foundation of our natural rights. This is why the Declaration says we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. Okay, my second point. The natural right of liberty does not mean that we are free to do simply whatever we desire without moral restraint. The founders distinguished liberty from license. Liberty is the exercise of freedom within the bounds set by the natural law. License is the use of freedom contrary to the natural law. The founders did not conceive the human person as an unbounded, autonomous individual, free from any constraints except those imposed by his own will. In the founders' understanding, natural rights were not unbounded. We've forgotten this lesson. We don't understand what they think. I mean, quite the opposite is true. The founders understood, and they say this over and over and over, natural rights are limited by the natural law. And I'll give you just a few quotations. James Wilson, leading founding father, says, "The laws of nature are the measure and rule. They ascertain the limits and the extent of natural liberty." Thomas Jefferson characteristically puts it in terms of limiting our freedom based on the rights of others. No man has a natural right to commit aggression on the equal rights of another. If I may speak bluntly, to say that the founders believe that there are no morally wrong or bad choices, as my friend Patrick Deneen writes, or to suggest that freedom for the founders was unbounded by anything except the self-creating self, as David Schindler does, these claims are absurd. If you actually spend time reading and writing what the founders wrote and thought, you cannot reach the conclusions that the neo-Catholics reach. The founders understood natural rights to be part of the natural law, and as such, the exercise of natural rights were properly limited by the natural law. Because the founders believed in the existence of the natural law and believed it imposed moral obligations on individuals, they rejected the philosophy of Hobbes, of Thomas Hobbes. When accused of advancing a Hobbesian theory of natural rights by Tory sympathizers before the Revolution, Alexander Hamilton explicitly rejected the charge. And I emphasize this point about Hobbes. I'll mention this as you look at this quote from Hamilton, because this is the common element of all the critics. They say, look, the founders were Lockean, and we all know Locke was really Hobbes, so the founders are Hobbesian. Well, one way to think about this is, what did the founders say about Hobbes? And here's the clear statement. Hamilton says, good and wise men disagree with Hobbes's absurd and impious doctrine. Those are Hamilton's words, absurd and impious, because they believe in God, they believe in God and understand him to be the author and authority of the law of nature. Hamilton does not conclude that only people who have access to divine revelation or God's prophets are subject to the natural law. Hamilton's not a Catholic natural law thinker, but he agrees with the Catholic natural law tradition, or just the natural law tradition simply, that we know the natural law through our rational faculties. We know the natural law through reason. This is why Hamilton can say, the natural law is binding all over the globe, in all countries, and at all times. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this, and such of them are as valid derive their authority immediately or immediately from this original. Upon this law, upon the natural law, depend the natural rights of mankind. And therefore, Hamilton concludes, in a state of nature, right, before there is positive law, no man has any moral power to deprive another of his life, limbs, property, or liberty. We are by nature constrained by the natural law. We have no moral right to harm others. Natural rights, in the founders' understanding, were not opposed to the idea of natural law or binding moral obligations. They're part of the natural law and the moral order created by God. So the founders' understanding of the rights-bearing individual was not an unencumbered, autonomous self. The founders understood the human person to have rights on account of our God-given human nature. God created us free and with the capacity for reason. Those essential attributes of personhood are the source of our rights and what makes us subject to the natural law. Okay, if my friend Patrick was here, he would respond as follows. I know this. He'd say, Munoz, even if you were right about the natural law and natural law limits on natural rights, those limits are still too minimal. Basically, I can hear him saying it in my mind. Basically, the natural law for the founders is don't harm others. Not harming others is hardly the whole of classical or Christian morality. The founder's account of freedom, he would say, is too thin. It amounts to freedom for nothing in particular, or at best, freedom for bourgeois, comfortable self-preservation, or what Pinkers calls freedom for indifference. And there is something to this response. The founders held that the primary purpose of government is to secure natural rights. A just political order, they believe, preserves freedom for its citizens, it does not necessarily command its citizens to use their freedom well. And by preserving freedom and protecting the rights of property, the founders believed that good government would encourage the creation of wealth. And that means for some, they knew, some would become very, very wealthy. The founders were not against comfortable self-preservation. But to conclude that the founders sought to protect liberty merely for the sake of self-preservation or comfortable self-preservation fails to understand the whole of their political thought, and it fails to account what the founders themselves said about the teleology of liberty and the reasons why we limit government. And the founders limited government first and foremost to protect religious freedom. The founders' commitment to religious freedom itself is premised on truths about religion and the nature of the human person. I'm going to put up a long quotation. Apologize for all this text, but I didn't want you to think I was making this up, right? This is from Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance. Madison's argument starts with, first, the recognition of the truth of religion, a truth about religion. Religion, or the duty we owe to our Creator and the manner of discharging it, he writes, can be directed only by reason and conviction, not force or violence. It's not that different from Dignitatis Humanae. Secondly, Madison's argument recognizes moral obligations to God. It's the duty of every man to render to the Creator worship consistent with one's conscience. Because religion by its nature must be exercised freely, and because we have moral obligations to worship God, and because those obligations are of higher authority than our obligations to other men or our political community, Madison concludes we have a right to religious liberty. So it's simply not true that the founders believe rights are prior to the good. The founders' commitment to religious freedom is not based on indifference towards religion. The exact opposite is actually true. Men have a right to religious freedom because they have obligations to God. Our duties to God ground our rights among men. The right of religious freedom exists so men can offer God proper worship. Without freedom, the founders believed, and I add Vatican II teaches, without freedom, we cannot worship God as he designed us to worship him. The principles of the American founding, properly understood, which is to say accurately understood, do not reject the idea of objective truth, do not embrace the idea that man is an autonomous individual who cannot make morally wrong choices. And the freedom of the founding is oriented towards the moral use of freedom. The truth about our foundational principles is that they affirm the existence of the natural moral law and understand the proper use of freedom to be bound by and to be ordered toward God-given moral obligations, including the worship of God. Okay. Look, I could say a lot more of that. I mean, I gave a bare-bone summary of the critics, and of course the critics are more complicated and sophisticated than I presented them, and they disagree with themselves. And it goes without saying the founding is more complicated in various than I presented. I've tried to present the essential matter of both positions. A more complete account of the founding would require all sorts of discussions. The military, local government, colleges and universities, primary schools, civic associations, free enterprise and markets, the family. All these are part of the liberal political order, and all of these in different ways and various ways were meant to sustain virtue and freedom. This lecture, in my mind, would be a success if I've simply encouraged some of you to not disregard the founders or blame them so easily. But let me say there's one more difficulty with my position or challenge to my position. I have to face a very difficult issue, which is the following. What does it matter if the founders believed in objective truth and natural law if we don't today? I mean, certainly our governing elites don't. And are we not the founders' heirs? Don't we live in the system that they created? So what good, if any, can their principles do for us now? I'm confident that restoring the authority of our founding principles would improve our political and moral life. The Constitution, properly understood, does not protect the right to terminate a pregnancy, most foremost. The logic of abortion, moreover, is anathema to the principle that all individuals are equal and possess the natural right to life. A return to our founding principles would help us restore a culture of life, at least on this important and fundamental issue. And in general, understanding our founding principles would better help us distinguish liberty from license. But all that said, we shouldn't exaggerate what political principles alone can do. Our principles, as good as they are, can't make us live well. Sound principles can explain the grounds of religious freedom, and good institutions can secure religious freedom, but they don't actually lead us to exercise our religion. The Declaration of Independence does not mandate homosexual marriage, which is a claim Patrick Brennan foolishly makes, but it doesn't lead us to have good marriages either. Our principles alone don't and can't make us good. So if we want to know what has gone wrong with America, we shouldn't blame our principles of political freedom, but we should probably look to how we've used our freedom as a people and how we've used it very badly. That's a whole nother lecture, very long lecture. But think about at least the following, right? We as a people don't really believe in nature as a standard. We reject natural rights and the natural law in our political and moral philosophy. Think about how we just uncritically embrace technology. Think about the collapse of mainline Protestantism, the decline of the family, terrible political judgments made by our courts, our executive branch, in our social policy by Congress, the massive dislocations resulting from the transition from an industrial to a post-industrial economy, the sexual revolution, every significant moral and political choice made by the baby boomer generation. These I say that as generation, taking pride in my Generation X status. That's why our country's in such bad shape, not because of the Declaration of Independence. I mention this, and I'll conclude with this last point. I mention this because it helps me to explain why I think this debate is important. We're not doing well. Our country is not doing well. For the first time in my life, my adult life, I find myself with all sorts of reservations about America. Do we as a people have enough virtue and wisdom to actually govern ourselves well, to choose decent people to govern us? I hope we do, but I'm not sure. And our decay necessarily leads us to ask, as I've said, what went wrong and what should we do? But if we believe our founding principles are corrupt, there's no reason for us to attempt to save America. If it's going to collapse, why not just let it collapse now so the task of rebuilding a new regime on new principles can begin? The necessary consequence of the critics' conclusion is withdrawal and a certain emotional detachment from the country and from politics. Why fight for America if America is really not worth fighting for? And I think that's a terrible and unfortunate and perhaps a fatal response, because America is worth fighting for. America's far from perfect. We know that our nation, even with good principles, we know that we failed to live up to those principles. But it is true that all men are created equal, that no man rightfully rules another man without his consent, that we have certain natural rights, and among these is the inalienable natural right to religious liberty. These truths are consistent with our human nature as God created it. Our freedom is a gift from God, and it is the necessary condition for the proper worship and love of God. America, at this particular moment in history, needs all the friends she can find. It pains me that many of my friends and our friends fail to see what is truly noble and good in our principles of our founding. Thank you very much. Thank you.